From the community room at Umslett Grand Center, welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The Congressional Medal of Honor is the highest honor awarded to members of the U.S. military. Recipients are recognized for their valor in action. It has been awarded 3,500 times since inception in the Civil War. More than half of the medal winners won posthumously. We are proud to have one of those recipients with us now, retired Army Captain Flo Groberg. Born in France, he came to this country as a youngster and became an American citizen at the age of 18. He enlisted in the Army 7 years later. His gallantry surfaced when he intercepted a suicide bomber bent on attacking a group of American officers. The incident left Captain Groberg with serious injuries requiring many months of treatment and rehab. His story is told in his book, 8 Seconds of Courage, A Soldier's Story from Immigrant to the Medal of Honor. Ladies and gentlemen, Flo Groberg. Flo, thanks for being with us. It's a great honor for me to have this opportunity to talk to you.
No, Don, the honor's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you. Let me begin this way. What was it, Flo, do you think, early in life or as you were growing up, that gave you the courage and the motivation to do what you did in the war?
Well, I think, you know, life is all about a sequence of actions. And, you know, I had a great opportunity to grow up with, you know, strong parents. I was lucky enough to have a father who adopted me. He's from Gary, Indiana, and he ended up somehow in France and decided to marry my mother and take me in. And I think he was a big influence in my life in regards to who I became as an individual. He guided me early on. He gave me a foundation for success, and he gave me the right tools to succeed. And then going from my high school days, you know, running track, playing soccer, going to school, all the events, to the University of Maryland, I think that my experiences, the people that I was around, my influencers, my idols, and my coaches and my teachers really paved the way for me to succeed as an individual. And lastly, really, it's the people around me in the military. Easiest decision I ever had to make was to go out there and do my job on August 8, 2012. That's what we do every day. We do it for love.
I have a quote here from your father that I thought that you produced early in the book.
Yeah,
and I think that had a great deal to do with what we're talking about as well. There was some suggestion at some point in your life that you wanted to quit whatever it was you were doing. And he said, if you quit Ranger School, you will always find a reason to quit anything. Sounds like a pretty good motivator to me.
He said that to me a few times. Like a few times in my life, I had those thoughts about quitting. And I think that's just being a human being. And he was a man of very few words, Don. I mean, I say very, very few words. But he's never quit anything in his life, and he sure as heck didn't want his son to quit anything in life. And he taught me something that's really important. He said, you know, when you start something, you finish it, no matter what comes around. Because the day you quit because things get tough is a reason that you'll quit everything that you start the rest of your life.
Particularly good advice for military and working with others.
I would agree.
Right. Tell us about your uncle. He also is someone you referenced early in the book, and he also was an inspiration to you, but in a much different kind of way.
He was my favorite person in the world. I don't know. I was just drawn to him as a child, and he was just this incredible man. He was a teenager when I was born. He was born in 1972. I was born 11 years later, and I just wanted to be near him and next to him. I related to him. I loved him with everything that I had. And he loved me back. I mean, obviously, even though it was family, but he took me everywhere. And I promise you, Don, I was annoying. I was very annoying. And so I'm still am to this day. But he was that one individual, other than my mother at the time and obviously my father, that I just wanted to be around. And so I wanted to be like him. And obviously what happened to him in 1996 when he was killed by a terrorist in Algeria. He was murdered. And the fact that, you know, the way he was murdered and what they did with his body, which is, very clearly described in the book, that influenced me to be the individual that I am today.
And to point yourself toward the military, I gather.
Absolutely. So that was my first real experience, you know, personal experience with terrorism and evil. And 9/11 was obviously my catalyst in regards to my future path. When I became naturalized, as you mentioned in your introduction, as an 18-year-old in February 2001, you know, you fast forward a couple of months later and the 9/11 attacks. And so I thought that, one, they attacked my family. Oh, and so that was very personal. And now they attack my adopted country. And so I wanted to be a part of the solution. Yeah.
The early days in the military were not easy ones, and they never are for people who go into the service.
Oh, they're fun, though. You know, and then nothing in life is supposed to be easy. Nothing that's good in life is supposed to be easy, in my opinion. And so we had some tough moments, and Ranger School obviously was my tough moment. I'm pretty sure they designed Ranger School to make it very, very hard. Oh, yeah. And out of the 333 individuals who started in my class, only 69 of us made it through. So attrition rate was really high, and that's because they want the best of the best. And I was lucky enough, and I say the word lucky, because to go straight through in Ranger School, you have to be lucky. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to have outstanding soldiers by my side who really helped me in some of the tough moments.
Yeah, there were a couple of instances there where I guess that's where your father's advice came into play about quitting. You wanted to at some point.
Oh, I was done.
Yeah.
I was done. I thought this was stupid. I mean, this whole no eating and no sleeping, carrying 100 pounds and walking around for 23 hours in a day, this is just ridiculous. I wanted to quit. I mean, I was going to quit. Plus, I thought I lost a piece of equipment, so I thought I was going to get kicked out anyway. But I had some really good influencers around me, such as Sergeant Gallardo, who is an incredible, incredible man. Silver Star recipient, was shot in the head a couple years prior in the Korangal, and actually Sal Junta, who is the first living recipient since Vietnam to receive the Medal of Honor, was part of that patrol. Mm-hmm. And so he... He had a different way of motivating me to not quit.
Yeah. I want to move on to your experience overseas. But before we do that, there's a question that I think should be asked at this particular time in our history. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be interviewing Khazir Khan, the father of the Army officer who was killed in Afghanistan, I guess it was. And you may remember him at the Democratic National Convention.
Oh, yeah.
And the reaction to him. When you were watching that or when you heard about that, what was going through your mind?
See, how funny you asked that question. So I was chatting with him right before he said all that stuff.
You were? Well,
yeah.
Tell us
so
about
I
that.
I was in a green room with him. We're chatting with his wife. We're talking about his son because he spoke, and then there was another individual that spoke, and then I spoke at the DNC. So, yes, for all you Republicans, I'm a military guy who spoke at the DNC. And I'd do it again if I could. But reality is, like, he was an incredible man. And just how humble he was and how appreciative he was when I was having a conversation with him. And I'm telling him, like, you know, your son is the representation of our nation in regards to making the ultimate sacrifice. I have four of my brothers, Commander Sergeant Griffin, Major Gray, Major Kennedy, and Reggie Abdel-Fattah, never came home as well. And so when you're talking to a Gold Star family, everything sort of stops, right? I mean, you really pay attention. You want to make sure you don't say the wrong things, one, and that you want to hear their stories about their son or daughter because it's so important to them. It's so important to us, so important to me because I can relate, but not to their extent, right? Mm-hmm. It's so personal for them. I did not realize he was about to go out, about to go on stage and pull out the Constitution and have one of the most powerful speeches of all time. This speech will be remembered forever. Mm-hmm. He really brought down the house.
And the reaction to that speech from the president?
Which one? Because the president was still President Obama.
Well, the president who is president now.
Well, I think, you know.
He was a candidate then, obviously.
And the response was a response of an individual that obviously never had a conversation with Mr. Khan. And I think it's really important for us to remember the importance of our Gold Star families, the importance of supporting our service members' families, and really people who wear the uniform and go out there to make sure that we get to live in a world that we live in today, and specifically in this country. Look, we got a lot of things to fix in this country, but one thing for sure is we have the best men and women who go out there and put their lives on the line day in and day out to make sure that we live in the best country in the world. And so I just thought that Mr. Khan's speech was really powerful, and I thought that his son's sacrifice is a representation of the best of our country.
The comment following that by the then candidate, Donald Trump, was pointed directly initially at Mrs. Khan.
Right, and, you know, that's something that I'm sure that a lot of people would wish for him to take back. But he made a comment. You know, he's got to live with that comment. I think the The media did a really interesting job of pushing it. That's not something that anyone wants to hear. And really, we lost focus in that moment. We lost focus in that moment because we're talking about a family that lost a son. And we're talking about a family that lost a son to a suicide bomber in, you know, serving while serving our nation. And so that was the part that really got to me, is the fact that we're not honoring him by having these type of conversations.
As you point out so clearly in the book, it is difficult enough to lose a good friend, which you did, several of them, as a matter of fact. It's hard to imagine what it would be like to lose a child.
I can't imagine. Yeah. You know, I've lost, I can't imagine. I've never, first of all, I don't have any kids. So that's, you know, just so anyone knows, I don't have any kids. but, you know, I know the pain it is to lose an uncle. I know the pain it is to lose friends. I cannot imagine the pain of losing a son or a daughter.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. Let's do that now, and we'll come back, and we'll talk with Flo Groberg. In just a moment, we're talking about his book, 8 Seconds of Courage. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back now with Flo Groberg. We're talking about his book, 8 Seconds of Courage. And we'll get to the heart of that story in just a moment. But Flo, let's kind of build up to it. You had two deployments to that part of the world. Tell us about the first deployment.
First deployment was an incredible experience, and really in a positive way. When I got to Afghanistan in December of 2009, I was green as it gets, no experience. And here I was, and meeting with my battalion commander, Colonel Pearl, and he's telling me I'm taking over Dagger 4 platoon that is located at combat outpost Honecker Miracle. And I had 24 men under my command. And he told me, you know, to lead them right and make sure that, you know, I follow my training and do all the right things, right? And so that's great. I walked out of that meeting scared. First time in my life I was that scared. And I wasn't scared of dying, because everybody dies. I was scared of getting people killed by not being the right type of leader. And so it really took some courage internally to go out there and find my most senior NCO, non-commissioned officer, which was at the time Sergeant First Class Corey Staley, and tell him I need support. I talked to him. I told him I'm going to take my pride. I'm going to take my ego. I'm going to take my rank. I'm going to put him to the side. I need you to teach me, guide me, and mentor me to being the right type of leader for this platoon, because my priorities are to take care of my men and accomplish the mission in that order. I'm a firm believer that if you take care of your men, you will accomplish the mission. And the day that you fail to take care of your team is when you will fail the mission. And so him being an outstanding leader himself, you know, he told me to shut up over the course of the next 7 days and really to watch and observe and pay attention and learn, watch the way we react to contact, listen to the way we communicate back to base and communicate internally with each other, the way we return fire, and learn everything about the area of operation, all the historical battles, the 7 villages I was going to own, and then learn, talk to the men, figure out where they're from, why they joined the army, but don't get too close. And long story short, you know, we're going to get a plan from the boss, the captain, and we're going to come up with our own plan. We'll brief it to the team. If they have any input, we'll include it, as long as it makes sense. And then he gives me 7 days. In 7 days, I'll give you a platoon ready for your leadership, he told me. And so we did so. I listened. It was tough. It was tough to shut up for 7 days, but I did it. And the dividend it paid is the fact that, you know, we were in over 200 engagements that tour, and everyone came home.
There was another incident or two in that first deployment that really caught my attention, and that was the visit to the girls' school. You had two visits, as I recall, and maybe it was a return to the same one again. But tell us about that, what you found there, and ultimately, there were casualties at a girls' school, and the way that was handled.
Yeah, so the girls' school was one of the most powerful moments in that first tour. And I'm glad you asked that, Don, because nobody's ever asked that question so far. We've been doing this for 2 weeks, and nobody's ever brought that question up. And it's one of my favorite stories, because we're in the most kinetic place in the world at the time, where, you know, women can't go to school. But because of our work, not just fighting the enemy, but our work with the community, they opened up a girls' school. And I walk in there, and I'm the first male to be allowed, that's not obviously a male teacher or Afghani, to get into the school. They told me that I could go in there, which probably in hindsight was not the smartest idea of my part to allow that to happen, because here I am in an enclosed compound by myself, and I saw hundreds of little girls, and guess what they were learning?
What?
English.
English, yeah.
English. Had the alphabet right there. And so I took a picture with the girls, and I took a picture with the teacher, and it was just a powerful moment of what we had accomplished in the Kunar province. Mm-hmm. They don't have electricity, but they have a girls' school. Think about that. It's tribal, right? They speak multiple languages in that area. You know, speak Dari, Pashtun. Mm-hmm. And we got to do this. Unfortunately, a couple months later, we had a short round. So the enemy ambushed our battalion commander, Colonel Pearl, with some pretty heavy weaponry. And he called a fire mission from our base. And one of the base plate of a mortar tube kicked up, and they're supposed to be really stable. And the girls were coming out of school, and the round landed as they were coming out of school and killed two little girls.
And there was a question of compensation. This is what really caught my attention, Flo. There was a question of compensation for this tragic accident. And you can tell the story, but what I'm referring to is the man who wanted compensation for his cows.
Yeah. So, obviously, you know, the boss was taking some heavy fire, so we went as quick reaction force, my team. And when we got there, we had enemies on the ridgeline firing some RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, and some good AK-47 at us. But it was nothing too serious. They're pretty far away. And then we start, obviously, unleashing hell on them with our weapon system. So it got pretty quiet. And the boss goes, I need you to go into that village and take pictures of these kids that were supposedly killed. And the reason he said this is because, one, we need evidence that that's the truth. Two, they lied about that stuff all the time because they knew that we would pay. So we decided at that point in the tour, like, you know, if we did kill kids, which didn't happen often, and it was obviously always a mistake, or if we killed, you know, any civilian casualties, that we need to take pictures and write and do a report, investigation on it. It's just the way you would do it here. And so he asked me to travel around this open space and go into this village and take pictures of these kids. And I did so with my team, and I told them as before we walked into that village, I said, everyone's weapon on semi, fingers off the trigger, because I have no idea what we're walking into. But if you killed my kid, I'm probably not going to be happy about it. And as we walked in there, I asked, I had my translator, and I told him ask the elder, you know, of the village, if we could take pictures of these kids. And he showed me the kids, which was gruesome. And I asked if it was okay to take pictures. And I thought, honestly, that his reaction would be, you know, screaming at us and all stuff. Instead, he said, yeah, take your pictures, but you need to compensate me for the cows. I said, what are you talking? What cows? You know, so I thought my translator was messing up the translation. He's like, apparently we killed a cow too. Like, and so he wanted $10,000 equivalent for a cow, and like a couple hundred dollars for the girls, you know? And that, to me, was the most disgusting thing that I've ever seen in terms of humanity, that you want more for a cow than a child. But that's the way it works there, because
it's the culture.
A cow feeds a family for 30 days, mm-hmm. and women are women to them.
Yeah.
You know, if there was been a little boy, he would have asked for $5,000. You know, but a couple hundred dollars, he didn't care as long as we pay for the cow. Mm-hmm. And that to me is a culture change. That's a culture shock.
Yeah.
And that was weird.
Well, let's get to the second deployment now. Just to fast forward a little bit, this was a different kind of a deal for you the second time around.
The second time around was supposed to be easy.
Yeah.
I got selected by the boss of bosses, right? At the time, Colonel Migas, he owned the entire eastern part of Afghanistan. He had 45 different outstations, which are bases, 6 different provinces. And all I had to do was just run the security. So really, for 6 months, it was great. I flew in helicopters every day. Love helicopters, as long as they don't crash. And I got to go see Afghanistan from a completely different perspective. I actually got to understand some of the decision-making process that happens from the higher-ups. A lot of the questions I had my first tour, like, why the heck are we doing this? Makes no sense. Now I actually got to see it because I sat in certain meetings. I got to escort, you know, the Ambassador Olson, into some very interesting places. But it just kind of rewired me almost to an extent where I was super excited to be a part of the Army, and I love what I was doing, and I got to work for the best leader that I've ever had in the military, which was at the time Colonel Mingus.
You got very close to these folks at that time. Not that you weren't close earlier on in the first deployment, but it seemed to me in reading the book there was a special kinship you had with these people that you were in essence protecting.
Yeah, it's a different mission. The first mission was to find, fix, destroy the enemy. So we went out every day in the mountains, and we just, you know, pick a firefight, right? Find the enemy and eliminate the enemy, and obviously take care of the local populations and villages as well. This mission was more of a personal security detail, which all I did as a team of six, including myself, and all we did was protect Colonel Mingus and Command Sergeant Richard Griffin everywhere they went. At times, very boring, because you know they're in meetings every day. At times, very interesting, and it was an incredible experience, but completely different missions.
Well, tell us about the day that changed your life.
Well, the day that changed my life is obviously something I'll never forget, August 8, 2012. But really, the night prior is what started the whole situation. The night prior, I made a phone call to the receiving unit. And so what we were doing, we were going to a security meeting in eastern Afghanistan in a city called Sadabad. And we've been there quite a few times already in this tour. The meeting happened every Wednesday at 10 a.m. It's been happening for years with Governor Wahidi. And so for us to get there, we had to fly from Jalalabad to this little combat outpost called Fayaz, land there, and then walk outside a wire, so outside the base, about 1,100 meters, into the compound where the meeting was. Nothing had happened there in years. It was green as it gets. I used to operate in that area my first tour, so I knew it very well. But there was we had rules. And every time we left the wire, left the base with our team and the boss, we needed an escort of 12 to 15 soldiers. And so the night before I called, and some major from the 101st, so part of this special unit that was out there, not part of my unit, but another unit, said that, oh, you don't worry, we're going to walk the route 15 minutes prior to your arrival with your boss and my boss and clear it and secure it. I mean, it just made no sense to me. So I put him on mute. I'll never forget this. And I had the adjutant next to me, Lieutenant Castle. And I told him, I said, look, I told the lieutenant, I was like, look, I'm going to tell this guy, I'm going to repeat my request, and he's pretty much going to tell me to screw off. And so I unmuted him. We went through it. I was like, hey, sir, tomorrow I'm bringing two brigade commanders, three battalion commanders, an Afghan general, two GS-15 State Department folks, two majors, plus my security element. I require 12 to 15 escort. And he's like, he told me to F off, literally, and he hung up. And I figure he's having a bad day. We all have bad days over there, that he's going to go to bed, realize that his boss's bosses is coming, so maybe it's a good idea to wait. Instead, when we landed on August 8, 2012, he had left. He took off 15 minutes prior with that escort. What he did, though, is the most interesting piece, is that he cleared the area, but he left the area, which is one-on-one in the military. If you're not there, then it's no longer secure. And so the boss, as soon as we landed, wanted to walk towards the compound, and you have to adjust on the go. And so I remember sort of thinking, this is not good, this is not good, this is not good, because as soon as we got off the helicopter, he's walking. So Colonel Mingus is walking. Colonel Walraff is walking. The other three battalion commanders are walking. So I'm here with my six guys. I'm thinking, well, this is not good. And so what I did is I saw some Afghan National Army that were by the checkpoint, and I grabbed them. Almost 10 of them, and I put them, and I said, you're coming with us. They're like, what? I'm like, I don't care. You're coming with us. And I put them up front. I told them to spread out so we appeared bigger. And then I told my platoon sergeant, who was always in the back, to get up front and control the pace of our walk. And then I took C Corps, one of my privates, and I put him up front too. Then we had a diamond, and that's how we put ourselves in a diamond. So one, two, three, four, and we put the principals inside that diamond. So in case we got attacked, we would collapse on the principals, and the 12 to 15 escort would fight the fight, right? Well, I don't have 12 to 15 escorts. Instead, I had two guys that I picked up, Americans, that I put in. One of them was a contractor I'd never seen in my life, probably like, don't get me wrong here, I think he was like 50 or 60 years old. Guess what?
A kid.
I loved that guy at that point. And then I had Sarn O'Brien. I used to be on my team years prior. And those Afghan soldiers. And we just went on. And as when we got about 700 meters into the movement, I think the enemy noticed the fact that, you know, we were not well protected. And they came at us with two motorcycles, which was a diversion. Afghan National Army did a heck of a great job, actually, of taking care of that threat. At the same time, a man came out of the structure to our left, young man, maybe 20 years old. And he was walking backwards, parallel to our patrol, did a 180-degree turn, and then another 90-degree turn and came towards us. I left my position, ran towards him, screamed at him some nice words. When I got to him, I hit him with my rifle, realized that he had something on his chest. Sarn Mahoney, my RTO, was to my left behind me, started following me into it. I grabbed him, realized he had a suicide vest, and I just did what you do. You know, you do your job. And so I threw him as far away as possible, as quickly as possible. Which, by the way, Don, I was working out for 6 months, getting ready for the best ranger competition. I was pretty swell, strong. And I realized that everything that I did for 6 months didn't do nothing because I threw him right at my feet. He went nowhere. So and he landed on his chest. I saw Mahoney, as he was falling down, pushed him down. And so to force him to land on his chest, and he detonated.
Yeah. This was the 8 seconds that we're talking about, right?
8 seconds. All that took 8 seconds.
Okay. It detonated. That took care of him, but it also took care of you.
It really took care of Command Sergeant Major Griffin, Major Gray, Major Kennedy, and Reggie Abdel Fattah. I'm here today. I'm blessed. I'm lucky. Yeah. I woke up, and I realized that I'd been hit. I didn't know it was a suicide bomber. I had a pretty severe traumatic brain injury. Well, they call it mild traumatic brain injury. I don't know what severe is. But I couldn't remember what had happened. I just knew at that point that I had to get myself out of the kill zone. And so I was dragged into a ditch after the team found me on the middle of the road. And my leg was, you know, foot's facing me, fibula was sticking out. But what's incredible is the fact that a man blew up on my feet, and I was thrown 20 feet and lived. Mm-hmm. With minimal injuries, in my opinion. I mean, it was, you know, I guess they call them severe, but I thought it was pretty minimal. And four individuals, great Americans, were killed that were almost 30 feet away from the blast. Mm-hmm.
How many survived? How many others survived as a result of what you did?
I believe 24 survived.
Yeah.
But that's four too many didn't come home.
Of course. And again, pointing out that these were people that you regarded so very highly.
Specifically, Command Sergeant Major Griffin, I spent every single day with over the course of 6 months. And him and Colonel Mingus were two father figures. More so, in a way, Command Sergeant Major Griffin, because I used to just, you know, sit around in his office and talk about everything in life.
It began for you a different kind of a journey, Flo. Obviously, many, many months of treatment and rehab. Your injuries were serious enough to keep you in the hospital for Walter Reed. How long?
So I was there for really, it's 3 years, but you got to understand that became my duty station after a while. Really, a year and a half of my life was spent with surgeries after surgeries. I spent 4 months inpatient and then another just over a year going back in, outpatient and had about 33 surgeries, which is nothing compared to two.
That may be easy for you to say. It sounds like a lot to me.
Oh, I know a couple of my friends who have had over 100.
Well.
And so, you know, and they'll quit to tell you that I only had 33. So
you had a fairly distinguished visitor at one point at Walter Reed.
I did. I've had a few, but this one is very special. And this one was President Obama on September 11, 2012. He was in my room for about 10 minutes. We talked about, we're both Chicago, you know, guys. Yeah. And so he talked about the Bears being the best football team in the NFL. We talked about the Cubbies. Don't worry, he doesn't like the Cubbies. He's a White Sox guy. We talked about life and how proud he was of me and my service and my family for being there. And it was unbelievable.
You point out in the book that there was a genuineness about this. It wasn't just a high-ranking person coming by and shaking hands and then moving on.
No. I mean, I knew someone told him that my name was Flo, but it was like a movie. because you wait. They tell you the president's here in the morning, right? They wouldn't tell you. And so, like, Secret Service comes out there, cleans, you know, checks all the rooms, all the cabinets, all some weird stuff. And they tell you, you have to stay in your room. You can't walk out. And I have to say this. You know what my mother does? She doesn't like when someone tells her she can't stay in her room. This is Secret Service with the President of the United States. She left and was kindly escorted back into the room by Secret Service. But he came in, and it's like he kicked the door. He's like, hey, how you doing, Flo? And I'm like, oh, man, Mr. President, how are you? And he spent 10 minutes and just talked to us like human beings. And that started a friendship with that gentleman.
We have to take another break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the next time that you met the president, yeah. And then we'll be taking questions from the audience. We're talking with Flo Groberg. We're talking about his book, 8 Seconds of Courage. You just heard where that title came from. Back in a moment, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Flo Groberg, the Medal of Honor winner. We're talking about his book, 8 Seconds of Courage. We've talked about his military experience up to the point where he was severely injured in Afghanistan. And as he was recovering from those injuries, he had a chance to meet President Obama. You just heard him talking about that before the break. Now let's talk about the next time you met the president. Another big day in your life, which you'll never forget, I'm quite sure.
Absolutely. So I had opportunity to see him in 2013 at the White House with the Miami Heat, and then I had an opportunity to see him the day before the medal at the Veterans Day breakfast. But on November 12th, 2015, that was one of the most emotional days of my life, aside from August 8, 2012, because I got to stand on the stage with the President of the United States and all these cameras and a lot of, you know, military leadership, but really my family, Carson and Carson's family, Carson, my fiance, and most importantly, the three Gold Star families. And, you know, President Obama had an incredible speech. I have no idea what he said, but I'm sure he's incredible. But the reason I say that is because the entire time I was, once sweating like crazy. It was super hot. And I followed my father's advice. And people asked, what are you talking about? I said, I asked my father a week prior, you think it's okay if I sit down during the ceremony? And he said, why the heck would you sit down during the ceremony? I said, well, I don't, Clint Romachet received the medal, so Clinton Romachet. He hates when I call him Clinton, so I call him Clinton Romachet. We sat down, and I figured that'd be normal. And my dad said, you're an infantryman. You stand up. And so here I am, the president speaking. I got all my loved ones in front of me. I got my brothers in front of me. I got the Gold Star families in front of me. I got SecDef and everybody else that matters in the military to my left. And I'm standing in front of all these cameras, and I am struggling. I'm struggling, and I'm shaking. My legs are shaking. My mother's in front of me. All she's doing is making this gesture with my nose because my nose is running. And she's like this. And I'm looking at her. I'm in a position, you know, I'm in parade rest. And I'm thinking, no, I can't do this. And I can't, you know, and she's going like this. So I'm getting all frustrated with this moment. And then I'm looking at my father, and he's smiling. And I'm super angry at him because I should have taken that chair. I don't know what the president was saying because, I'll be honest with you, it was 8 seconds of action. And he spoke for quite a long time. And then when I saw the man with the medal come, which was my cue to make a half right and start staring at his chandelier, and I knew that the individual was going to read the citation, I started thinking, okay, finally, because I'm thinking I'm going to fall off. I'm going to fall off stage. My legs are going up and, you know, I'm going down, and I'm thinking this is it. I finally see the man. I'm thinking, okay, this is great. Now I just get to half right, look at the chandelier, it'll be 2 minutes, the president will put the medal on me, and it's over. This is the longest citation of all time for 8 seconds. He kept talking. So at this point, I had a decision to make, which I honestly, I can't make this up. I was looking in front of me, I'm thinking, I'm going to fall on that man, or I have a choice to fall backwards on the president of the United States. And so by the time I made my decision to fall backwards, he was putting the medal around my neck, and it was all over. But it was the just to be hailed as a hero was one of the most one of the hardest moments of my life because I almost felt shame. I felt shame because here I am, people are celebrating a hero, which I absolutely do not like that word. And I have three families in front of me that lost a loved one on that day.
That's a point I wanted to make. The wives of the men who died in Afghanistan that day, years earlier, they were very supportive of you, obviously, and I detected an emotion and a love between those women and you that was very palpable in reading the book.
Well, it started right after August 8, 2012. I mean, you're over here in a hospital bed and blaming yourself for, as you have survivor's guilt. And it took a couple of them a little bit of time to, call me or show up. But when I was told about the medal in September, I remember talking to Carson about this. And I told her, I said, the one thing that we need to do is call the families, because I'm not doing the ceremony unless the families are going to be there. Because I felt weird. I mean, again, the same comment that I made earlier, you're going to put the medal around my neck and celebrate August 8th, the worst day of my life, and these families have to live with the consequences of the actions of their loved ones on that day for the rest of their lives.
You felt somewhat guilty for their deaths.
Of course, absolutely. Yeah. It is on me. No matter what anybody says, that's my responsibility. I ran that security patrol on that day. And so, though we did everything that we could, right, it is still on me. I still lost four men under my patrol.
Yeah. I'm going to just take you back just a little bit now because I'm interested in what your thought process was when they called and told you that you had won the Congressional Medal of Honor.
Well, we didn't know exactly what it was going to be. And I remember I took a half day off, and Carson took a half day off, and we met back up around noon because the call was going to happen between the hours of 2 and 2:30 in the afternoon.
You knew a call was coming.
So I was in a I love telling this story because it's so ridiculous. It's like a movie. I'm in Area 51 the week prior and doing some training for where I used to work, and my phone never worked. My cell phone never worked. I mean, the only way I talked to Carson was this landline that we had up there. And I'm walking. I'm done eating lunch. And I still have my cell phone in my pocket for some odd reason. And probably because I'm playing solitaire. And I'm walking across, this courtyard, dirt courtyard, and my phone rings. It freaked me out. So I'm looking at it, and 000 stuff. I'm like, oh, okay. Pick it up, and it's like, hey, is this Captain Grober? I'm like, I'm a civilian at this point. I'm like, yeah, retired. And he says, oh, this is Colonel Slane with the Pentagon. I'm calling you to let you know that you're going to have a senior high-ranking official that will call you on September 21st between the hours of 1400 and 1430. Is this a good number? Yes. Okay, don't miss it. And he hung up. And I was like, what? And then it went dead again. Like, no, aliens exist, and the government can definitely turn on my cell phone in weird places. I was convinced at that point. But we knew. We didn't know at the time if it was going to be the Distinguished Service Cross. We brought up the Medal of Honor with each other. We also didn't know if I needed to get myself a lawyer because I was being investigated for something. It was an interesting moment in my life.
Right. By the way, for the folks in the audience here, you haven't seen it. That medal is right up here in front of you. It's pretty impressive, pretty impressive. Great story. Thank you for telling it. But now let's get some questions from the audience. I gather a number of your friends here, military friends here?
No, it's just family.
Just family. Quite a family.
Family, yeah. We paid them.
How about some questions, folks? So did we. But that's another story.
We're winning.
Come on up. Those of you who have questions, come on up to the microphone here so that we can record it properly, if you would. And I'll take this moment to thank Left Bank Books for partnering with us on this program tonight. It's been an interesting evening so far, and perhaps even more so as we continue. But we're grateful for that opportunity.
Yes, an honor to be here. The major you talked about, was that an Afghan major or was that an American major?
I'm assuming you're talking about Cop Fayez?
Yeah, right.
American. So
the guy that took off.
Yes, and so at the time, what we did in 2012, we had this wonderful idea in the military, which actually worked in majority of places where we really wanted to focus on training the Afghans, right? And so we had these special units of folks from different units that would come around. They were training in the United States, and they'd come to Afghanistan, deploy, be embedded with our units, and their sole purpose in life was to actually train the Afghans, right? Really, to relieve some of the stress from special forces who have been, they just couldn't do it. You know, there's too many. And so this guy would never served in, as an infantryman. He was a logo, right? Logistics. And he didn't understand when you clear a route, if you leave, it is no longer secure. Literally, it's a four-year-old can do this. And he didn't do so. And so he's lucky. He's lucky that I could not remember his name to save his life, because I would have done everything to destroy him. I 100% would have never been so angry at a human being in my life than what he did. Because I knew that he put us in a bad position. I just didn't think he would do it. I thought it was such common sense for him to actually, you know, follow the simple rules in our military. But luckily, that his career was shortly ended.
Give me, if you wouldn't mind, sir, give us your name and then.
My name is James Jenkins. University of Maryland, when it was in the ACC, always had fabulous track team. They were the cream of the crop, no question about
100%.
It. What drew you to the University of Maryland as a track star, and do you think that helped you when you ran after this suicide bomber?
I love that. Love that. First of all, yeah, he's right. University of Maryland, 26 straight ACC championships. Very proud of that. Not when I was there, so let's be realistic. I lived in Maryland. I lived in Bethesda, Maryland. I went to high school in Maryland, so I was recruited out there, and I, you know, one of the few schools that recruited me. And so it was just, it made sense. It was local. I loved it. Great experience. Did it help me on that day? I don't think so. I think that at that point, I'm 29 years old. I'm way past my running days. And what helped me on that day was just the love of brotherhood and really the training that I received over the years and as a soldier, and the fact that I had a job to do and I was the closest one to him. And my job, my duty at the time was to get to him. And really the most important piece about that is the fact that, you know, we were supposed to protect Colonel Mingus and Commander Sergeant Griffin. And if we died that day and they lived, then that's a good day at work.
What kind of shape is your leg in today?
It's good. It's just skinny. I got skinny legs already. It sucks. You know, it looks creepy. I came out of the gym a couple years ago, and this little boy, maybe 4 years old, you know, is holding his mom's hands like, look, mommy, he's got a skeleton leg. And I turned around. I told him that's what happens when you fight with the monsters at night. And you freaked him out. Mom did not like that. Shouldn't have asked that question, kid.
You had to make a decision about that leg while you were in the hospital, whether to keep it or not.
Right, and I wished that I kept it. I went limb salvage, which is why I spent such a long time in the hospital. I wasn't going to go out there and cut my leg off. I would have hoped that the doctors would have made that decision for me. I wish they would have cut it. But now I'm keeping it until the day that they have those iRobot legs from Will Smith. Yeah. Because when they have those, I'm switching. And I'm flying off of soccer, MLS, retirement league anyway, so.
Did you, during this period of recuperation, when obviously you're in a lot of pain, did you have any concern at any point about becoming addicted to opioids or any of the stuff that they would give you?
I did, because I became addicted to IV Benadryl. Uh-huh. I could not go to sleep for months, and so to me, the only way I could go to sleep was by being injected with IV Benadryl, which, by the way, horrible drug, and it was unbelievable how in my head I could not, you know, go to sleep when I became outpatient without it. And so I went out there online and started researching about how to buy it, and you gotta catch yourself like, oh my gosh, like I'm being that person. You never realize like how quick an addiction becomes and how powerful it is, especially when your body craves it. And so I had great support from the nurses and the doctors, and when I went back for surgeries, they put me on different stuff. But I was lucky in terms of oxys, morphine, and that stuff. I'm pretty much allergic to it, where it makes me itch like crazy. So it was a big turnoff. And I don't like drugs. Yeah. I really don't.
You could have. You could have. If you weren't allergic to it, your needs were such that you could have become addicted.
Many have. Many have. Too many have.
That's why I asked the question. It's such a big problem today. And, you know, maybe what you'd have to say would be helpful to people listening who are bothered and have this situation. How about other questions from the audience? Here we go. Your name, please, sir, if you would, and then your question.
My name is John Davis. Flo, you've had a chance to speak to a lot of audiences about your experience across the country. My question is, what have you learned about this country as a result? What have you learned about yourself with this process?
So what I've learned about, John, great question. Thank you. What I learned about this country is willing to listen. This country is willing to be influenced in the right way. This country is looking for a beacon of hope. And that's what I've learned from my conversation. That's what I learned from going to great events and really having conversations with individuals. We are drowning right now in a lot of negative news, and we're focusing on the wrong things. And it's not just the media, it's ourselves. We have to look ourselves in the mirror. The day that you start having those conversations at a dinner table, the day you have the conversation at a coffee shop, the days you have this conversation at the water jug, you are part of the problem. And I'm part of the problem. And so we have to look ourselves in the mirror and realize that if we want to make a difference in this country, we need to start fixing ourselves first. And so that's what I'm seeing a lot. These people want to hear. They want to get inspired. They want to get motivated. They want to see some positive aspect. And they want to also understand how a person can go from survive such a lot of adversity and make something of themselves. What I learned about myself is that it's been the most therapeutic time of my life. I went through some tough times in the military, specifically early on, and I talk about that openly in a book about my survivor's guilt and the struggle that I had with my demons inside the hospital. And I had a great friend, Travis Mills, quadruple amputee, who really changed my life in 15 minutes with a conversation. But then it took years for me to really rewire myself, and I still have some tough times. Sometimes I have some bad nights. Some bad days. I still got some anger stuff that's going out there occasionally, specifically when I'm driving. I don't like people driving. But Carson, my fiance, changed that for me too. She changed me. She used literally that last piece of my life that I needed in my recovery because she brought that love aspect to it. I couldn't sleep at all for years. I mean, I was on Ambien. I was on all sorts of stuff. I don't know if I should say this. If you're listening and you're the VA, thank you for all the support that you're giving me. I need it. Can't sleep at night. But I'm like a baby now. So because of her, because she's been that light in my life, and she supported me through so much, but she's just showing me so much love. And I think that was really the biggest piece of my recovery. But I've learned so much about myself by openly having those conversations. It's healed me.
When are you two getting married? You've been together for a long time.
November 17th, 2018.
What the heck are you waiting for?
We were trying to do it on November 10th, 2018. I figured, we're doing a Marine Corps birthday, so I don't have to invite Marines to my wedding. Because guess what? Marines wouldn't skip their birthday for anything. By the way, you're talking to one. Hey, Don, you know why Veterans Day is on November 11th, right?
Why is that?
Well, it's not the First World War. It's not the First World War and all that stuff. It's because Marines love to party. And so they realize that on their birthday, they're going to go out all night. So they needed a holiday to recover the next day. So they made it Veterans Day.
Oh, boy.
It's a true fact. You're supposed to all laugh. Thank you.
I wish I had some of my former buddies with me tonight. We'd take you on, medal or no medal.
100% believe that. Hey, you're Marines, absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, say thank you to Flo Grover.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. A standing ovation for Flo Groberg. But that ends it for us for this session, Monday on St. Louis on the Air. We'll talk with Mark Leach about his new book, The Great Pyramids of St. Louis, an Ancient Metropolis. We'll also hear from TV news journalist Jane Pauley in advance of her upcoming appearance at the St. Louis Speakers Series. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Alex Hoyer and Lara Hamden, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Char Dastin, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Mary Edwards. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.